Everything is gray. This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today, as always, is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Bobby Ross. Bobby is a level designer at Wargaming, who previously worked at BioWare on Star Wars The Old Republic. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you on the show. It's awesome. I'd come across your work from your website, and you have these tutorials on level design that are like fully illustrated and like super high production value. So it was really fun reading through those as somebody who, you know, has done some rudimentary level design, but not really at this sort of AAA level. And just kind of thinking through some of those things that that you're talking about in there. So I thought it would be great to have you on and do an episode.
Yeah, I found that no one reads emails much, and definitely game documentation. So the more I actually turned it into images, the more people actually would read it.
Right. So it's for your benefit.
Yeah.
All right, guys, this is how you're going to design a level. So that's our topic, is level design in 3D games in particular. And so I thought a good way to kind of open it up would be to kick it off to you, Bobby, and to kind of talk a little bit like what your process or your thought process or your practical process that you go through when you're tackling, you're going to design a level.
Sure. Yeah. For me, definitely before I get into a level, there's a lot of questions to answer. Since the level is basically sort of giving, almost like you're having to direct a movie and have them solve a puzzle at the same time. So I usually try to start off with the smallest part of just figuring out what the mission design is, what are the objectives, how much time they have to do it. And then I'll go into basically sort of what are the different strategies and the different play styles. And once I know what those are, then I'll basically figure out what are the tactics of how do they achieve that strategy, like what are the abilities and the modifiers that they have. And then I finally can get into the level design, where I actually go through and just build out like the different flow maps, and even for the different play styles, and I'll figure out the scale and go into top down. And then finally I can get into the really fun stuff, like the blocking out and the play tests. And then once that's solid enough, then I can finally get to the art pass and stuff like that. So it ends up being a pretty heavy amount of work, but it starts with a very small amount, and you just keep getting it more and more solid, and then finally can do all the fun submission and play tests and focus groups.
Yeah, I hadn't thought too much about that sort of blocking out the level sort of stage. I've thought a fair amount about the, okay, we're planning this out, this is what the level's going to be like. And I thought a lot about, okay, we've now built it, it looks like a level, and then we're playtesting it. But I hadn't thought too much about, until I was watching a little thing that came from Naughty Dog on the Uncharted, are they in 3 or 4, whatever the upcoming...
They're getting on 4 right now, but they've only released 3.
Yeah, so it was on Uncharted 4 and how they'd given this really cool E3 demo and it looked amazing of this level and they're driving around and there's explosions and stuff. And it was like 3 weeks ago, and then it's like shows a screenshot that it's just like blocks with like a block sky and block things, and there's a road, but like you can only tell it's a road because it's just like a brown line, and like that was what they were at that point, because they're actually testing it out before it was fully fleshed out, which... it's kind of traumatic, the idea of like getting through all that in 3 weeks, but I guess when E3 is coming, that's what you do.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that ends up being pretty heavy crunch time for about every studio. Actually, if you even look at their multiplayer maps that they released for Uncharted 3, they actually would churn out a ton of multiplayer maps, and it was still in blockout stage. They didn't even try to artify it, so they could just keep it on, making sure it was fun.
And that's pretty common in level design, anytime you're doing a 3D game, because the art is, you know, so expensive and time consuming to get done in a modern big 3D game, that if you build the art before you've got everything right and you got to go back and redo some of it, then it's a huge expense and time sink. Whereas if you can block out the level and sort of verify like, yeah, everything gameplay wise works in this level, even though it's just like, you know, solid gray, flat shaded stuff everywhere, then you know, that's a pretty good thing, right? You're saving yourself a lot of effort.
Yeah, there's especially because you could get it perfect, and then they might change like how fast the player moves or add in some new weapons, and then suddenly you have to redesign some of your map for those new mechanics, and you're going to have to, like, yeah, redo all that art and all that time. So really saves you.
And art is one of those things that it's kind of okay for it to come in pretty hot at the end of a crunch kind of period. If you're making last minute changes to gameplay or any of that other stuff, you always got the potential to unbalance things. But the art, assuming that changing the art isn't changing the gameplay mechanics in any way by changing physics volumes or something like that, which if you sort of build things right, it doesn't need to. You can kind of turn the art on the last day, and it's not as much of a risk as some of the other things you could turn on the last day.
I'm sure the artists appreciate that, though.
Yeah, it's always the audio and the artists. Yeah, they'll definitely get the last step and all the heavy last-minute crunch. I've definitely seen some issues where it's like, yeah, you start trying to put in the art, and I've even done this to myself, where it's just I'll try to go through and make sure that there's like a pretty area, and then some of the cover isn't as effective anymore. Like people might try to shoot and the collision's all wrong or something like that. So people are like hitting things that are in that's invisible in the air, and that will create a lot of frustration.
Right, because you design this cover volume, you're like, oh, they should be able to hide behind something that's like, this is a thing obviously everyone makes fun of, but Nigel and I will particularly make fun of, is this level design where it's like, okay, there's going to be a firefight here, so there's chest high walls everywhere, mm-hmm. because they need to be able to hide behind chest high walls, because that makes sense, and so when in the level design stage, that totally makes sense. But then the artists are like, okay, how many things can be a chest high wall? Well, there's this really small car that's been flipped on its side. I guess that would be a chest about chest high. And then there's lots of fences with this exact same fence asset, and womp womp. And then I can imagine it being difficult because, as a level designer, you're like, okay, well, I know the character is about this size, and so kind of they need their cover to be roughly that size, and you want to be able to look over it, they want to be able to look around it, and if the artists are like, oh yeah, I think that thing is just going to be like a piece of grass, and suddenly the volume is that you need it to be is not equal to the volume that the grass asset is, and things
oh yeah on. Especially when you start getting to like any of the heavier stuff, your tanks or things of that sort. If you have vehicles in the game, and then you might have it to where those vehicles can then like jump off a ramp on top of a shack, and it's just like, why isn't that shack just like falling underneath the weight? And you start getting into all sorts of stuff where it could really take people out of the game, and so sometimes it can be a bit of a puzzle, yeah, for the artist of like, how do I make that look like it would work?
Yeah, I can imagine that. Cover in general, I think, is an interesting, not necessarily like flowing through any coherent, like, oh, let's go from the beginning of an end to level design. But cover is something that I find particularly interesting because it's a really like specific small thing that you deal with in the concept of designing a whole level. But it's kind of in itself, like you can see how it would go through that entire phase. You can see how it's like, okay, well, we're going to have a battle in this area, so we need to have cover. And then it's like, okay, where is it going to be? What are the consequences? Like, if we make it so that there's lots and lots of cover in this area, I'm not going to be able to clear, like, especially in like a player versus player area, like whoever gains control of that area are not going to be able to flush them out, or people are going to start camping. But if there's no cover, then you're just, it's chaos. And
yeah, it's amazing how important cover is. Like, even when I went into it, it's like, obviously you need to have cover, but especially the difference between basically like a linear single player game where it's just like you use cover and it really helps give the player choices and different routes and lets them know where they should go and where the big battle areas are. And then you have something like the multiplayer games where it could have like hundreds of thousands of matches. And even just like that one small bit of like that one rock, that one bit of cover can be incredibly important to where it could change the balance of like who wins or which team wins the game by like 5% or something much, much more of a larger impact than one rock would have in like a single player game. So yeah, cover is extremely important, and then it gets like exponentially important once you start getting into PvP.
It's something that's really kind of become a thing, especially in the last few years, it seems to me. Like, I think back to my heyday of doing competitive sort of multiplayer games. Like, I played a lot of like Quake 2, Quake 3, Unreal Tournament era online multiplayer, first person games. And, there was issues of, okay, there were places that you could hide, but now so many games in that school are either third person or have, some like hiding elements to them, like multi-levels of crouch, like the Call of Duty games and stuff like that, that it's, you know, now, like, all shooters are cover shooters, whereas when, like, you know, the first Gears of War game came out, everyone was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, there's stuff in the world you can hide behind. And this is incredible.
Yeah, it's because it, like, really slows down the players. So a lot of times you want to have it to where there's just almost no cover. People just, like, running around, maybe on top of a hill, like in Halo, versus, like, really big objects. And, yeah, then you start going into Gears of War, where there's so much cover that the maps are so small because it just slows down the players so much.
I didn't really think of, I've been playing, so for the audience, we had a couple months where we didn't have any episodes, and we're just kind of took a break. We were doing what we're now calling season one, and now we're starting season two. But part of, most of that was just we had a bunch of folks that were going to be on the show. They rescheduled because of conferences and stuff. But during that time, you know, it's like, oh, what all the games have you've been playing in the meantime? But one of the last episodes we had, Michael Lopp, Rance, came on and was talking all about Destiny, and he sucked me into the world of Destiny. So I played that for like, I'm just now getting off of it, but I played that for like 2 or 3 months straight. And I didn't think of it at all as like a cover-based shooter. And like in the game, you know, because you recover your health so quickly and just kind of the way that, and it you take so much damage before you die and stuff like that. So I didn't really think of it as a cover-based thing when I was playing in the single player, which isn't the great part of that game. But on the multiplayer, when you're playing in the Crucible, once you start, especially playing at the really high level, like the elimination version, the Trials of Osiris, and you're playing against people who are just like extremely good at this game, they're using cover in ways that you see them they see them destroying you, just like shoot duck, like they have a machine gun, then they're like ducking behind this thing just by kind of jiggling the joystick just imperceptibly so that it fires each shot, but then they get back behind this object that isn't even really necessarily intended as cover. Is just kind of this funnily shaped piece of rock or something like that. It's like, I don't know, I was just one of these guys who was like, as I was dying, I was like, man, that was awesome, you just kicked ass on it.
Yeah, there's some people that's like, it's almost like with how long it takes for a gun to shoot, it's basically sort of like an ability cooldown, and some people know exactly when it is, and they'll just like, yeah, pop up, let loose, and then pop back right down into cover, and they'll just get that skill down so well. It's just like, I've heard some people call it like peek-a-boom. But yeah, some people don't get really good at that.
Yeah, it hadn't occurred to me until like reading about people talking about like, oh, this gun is so good, you really need this one because it has these attributes or whatever. Kind of that it's like a theory crafting part of PvP shooter that I'd never really like gotten into before. And then talking about how this gun is really problematic, like in the Destiny terms, is like these assault rifles, I think they're called assault rifles, auto rifles. The auto rifles are really problematic because they fire so frequently for so long that you have to be out of cover for so long to kill someone. So even though they might do roughly the same amount of damage per second, it's way harder to manage cover than, say, a hand cannon that does that amount of damage in 5 bullets instead of 50, but you can sort of negotiate your cover while you're doing it. So,
Yeah, there was one game I thought I really liked that did that was Team Fortress, where it's just you had the heavy, and he had that big chain gun, but it took a while to spin up. And
yeah,
he's obviously got like a ton of health and stuff like that to make up for the fact that he's this giant, you know, like health sponge walking around. And then you had like the scouts, which had like the really fast like weapons that would just shoot up right off the bat, but obviously a very short range, so they just happen to just run all over the place and keep jumping all over. And yeah, it ended up being very fun to see those play styles go up against each other, where one is going from cover to cover as soon as possible and just doing hit and runs, while the other one is trying to stay out of cover and away, keep other players away from cover so he can then just mow them down.
Yeah, something like Team Fortress is particularly interesting because there's so many different classes that you sort of have to think, like, if we're going to have a map, there needs to be somewhere that all these people can do their things, but not excessively, right? Like, you want to have a place where they can snipe from, but not the place that, like, that you could never get at them, and that if they set up there, that the whole other team is just toast, and you know,
yeah,
a sniper.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really love about class-based games, and you'll kind of see even with other games, with just the different weapons will change how they have to play for their play styles, and that's what I'll usually end up doing with like my flow maps. I'll actually for the different strategies for the different play styles, once you kind of figure that out in the flow map, I'll actually go through and paint down and make sure that each one of those play styles has a place to go on the map, because like every single type of player, like you say, like a scout or a heavy or a sniper, any of those people are going to be playing the game, and they want to make, like, they want to have to know where to go to where they can have like their I'm a badass moment, like I'm cool. And you want to make sure that there's always one of that there's one of those areas or one of those routes that's specifically made to where they can go and show off how awesome they are and things like that. So yeah, you definitely want to make sure that every single map, that the more successful your map is definitely the more that you can actually go through and give the players those moments.
Yeah, I haven't actually played much of the sort of Unreal Tournament era games. Like, I've played them a little. Like, okay, yeah, I've played, but never, like, got very serious about it. And but from my memory of it, the sort of level design was very different from what we see now. I'm not sure if either of you having... I'm not sure actually how much Bobby's played those games, but, like, do you guys have much of a sense of, like, how much of that is just, like, adapting to the very different pace and feeling of the game? Like, it used to be that the old... map designs were very much like, where do the weapons spawn? Like, oh, this is the place where the grenade launcher spawns, and this is the place where the pistol spawns, and stuff like that. And, like, that's not something we see so much anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Especially, like, you'll still see it in Halo or things like that, where I feel like Halo kind of pulled up the torch, and you have, like, I guess Unreal is putting out a new Unreal tournament, while they'll be bringing that up. But I guess it's definitely very arcadey, for one, so you definitely see the real style, I guess... The games are trying to push for realism, that they'll have it to where you kind of start off with the weapons. But you also have it for, I think it's mostly to give the players the experience that they want, or allowing them to choose what experience they're going to have. So in a lot of those games, it makes that play style, like that weapon, like the sniper weapon. They just want to, a player wants to play maybe Unreal for 20 minutes, and he just wants to show off how awesome of a sniper he is or work on his sniper skills. But if he can't get to that sniper weapon because somebody else keeps taking it, then he's not getting the experience that he wants, so he might leave the game and go to something else. While with something like Battlefield or Team Fortress, they get to choose their weapons ahead of time, and they know they're getting to go in and play the play style that they want.
Yeah, I think that's definitely been the big design change that sort of drives what you're talking about, is just the move towards more class-based stuff and more pre-selection and... a lot more control gameplay. Like some of the later Unreal Tournament games did have control mode gameplay, but the early ones, usually the team-based stuff was just team deathmatch or capture the flag, which capture the flag tends to be just as fast-paced, if not more fast-paced than a deathmatch game. Whereas now it seems like in most newer games, you know, there's some control or objective element in the games, even in just kind of a competitive multiplayer context, that definitely slows things down a little bit and makes the structure of the maps different. I mean, there are still, you know, things that kind of throw back to the earlier playstyle, like the forthcoming like Unreal Tournament reboot. It definitely seems like it's got the same style as the earlier Unreal Tournament games, but yeah, it certainly seems like the slowed down class based objective control based games have kind of more become the norm in like 3D shooter competitive multiplayer games.
Yeah, I guess right now we're seeing Blizzard's Overwatch and Gearbox's Battleborn, and a lot of them are definitely coming out with more of the class based shooters and stuff like that. And that seems to be the next, or definitely the big push I'm seeing right now in video games.
I hadn't seen anything about Battleborn until I got to PAX on, I guess, Tuesday or Friday it would have been. And it's like, oh, they're giving out lanyards. And okay, we got a Battleborn lanyard. And then you get to the show floor, and there's like giant Battleborn booth with like every character. I somehow had not even heard of Battleborn. I guess it had been announced, and it just like was under my radar. And then like every single character from Battleborn in like professional cosplay waiting to take photos with you. And it was just like giant screens and explosions. And I was like, okay, apparently Battleborn
is... I just heard about Battleborn like 45 seconds ago when you mentioned it. It's definitely not, it's not something that has a super high profile up until fairly recently.
Yeah, there was, because usually a lot of booths, they'll maybe have like one statue. They had like five or six, maybe like six statues for every one of the characters. And some of them, like you said, were huge. It's like 20 feet tall, huge. It was crazy.
At first I was like, oh, this must be like some established thing that I had no idea, and I'm just a total noob. Maybe it's like only on Windows or something, and so I had not noticed it. But no, apparently it's just like an upcoming, like it's coming out in February thing that they're like super hyped about. Like they're putting a lot of like they're putting a lot of money where their marketing mouth is. I don't know if there's much known about it other than it is like definitely even in visual style, it reminded, as soon as I saw it, it reminded me of Blizzard's Overwatch, which is kind of weird that it has that if they're like both multiplayer.
Oh yeah. No, actually I worked on Firefall, and basically that game has like that exact same art style, and it's because it was started by people who left Blizzard.
Oh, really?
People who had worked on World of Warcraft and stuff like that, and they had left and then started their own studio, which was Red 5 Studios, and they were working on this game, which was Firefall, and then after a few years, there was some stuff that went down, a lot of money was, they weren't sure if the studio was going to close down, so a lot of people left and went back, and they were basically Team 4, so they were the ones that started like Titan and then Overwatch. So Overwatch is basically, it had the exact same concepts that we had on Firefall, and stuff like that. So it'll actually have a lot of the same thing, and you'll see a lot of that being used on, like on Battleborn and things like that as well. So they all look very similar.
It's definitely a style that seems to be coming kind of de rigueur right now. Like the cartoony isn't the right word, but it's sort of like, I don't know, like graphic novel-y or something like that. The like, you know, bright colors.
Yeah, and it has some action hero, superhero feel. And
yeah, like you've got that. The one from Epic, what's it called? Fortnite kind of, I think, has that same, you know, it's not like it's a ripoff or anything, but you can definitely see that there's, you know, something developing in that area of visuals rather than the usual, like, hey, you're running through a sewer and now you're in an abandoned military base kind of style. That
was it, Sunset Overdrive. And yeah, there was a, I guess even when I was walking around PAX, that was another thing I was noticing, which is even so many of the indie games too, so many people are picking that like very stylized, very bright colors, very very brightly lit. Especially it works well with multiplayer games because you can spot people so quickly, and so it allows for just like very fast paced, it establishes or at least promotes very fast paced gameplay. And then also just the mood itself is just so much more exciting and fun. And people seem to be pushing more for that and far less with a lot of the gritty Gears of War and some of the games we're having in the past.
Everything is gray.
Yes.
Yeah. That definitely doesn't, like when I have played those sort of, that very much was like in the PS3 era, it just became, and I've heard before that to some, for some reason, like the PS2, PS3 era, there was actually some technical reasons why doing muted color palettes was easier, that the way they did, I don't know, it was like radiosity or lighting or something like that, that like you could make things look more realistic if you had something that was really saturated, then the sort of lie would be told in the way some of the lighting was done. I don't know if that means if that rings a bell with you.
That's actually pretty plausible. Like there's definitely, you know, limitations in certainly what you can do in real time on that era of hardware in terms of how complicated your lighting equation can be. That, you know, very simple, brightly lit. Brightly lit isn't the right word. Like strong light sources, which strong light sources actually lead to dimly lit scenes, because strong light sources sort of cause lots of shadows. Like that's something that's kind of easier to do when you don't have complicated shaders, because you can just say like, all right, have a very simple lighting model, you know, either pixels in shadow or it's out of shadow. And if you want to make something that's like brightly lit and outdoorsy not look super flat and blown out, you need more complicated rendering techniques to do it.
Yeah, there's especially with the shadows, like you're talking about, where it's like you put a really heavy light and you get a really strong dark shadow and it'll have very crisp lines but will look very fake. So you try to like destroy, you try to remove some of that contrast, but I guess bringing down the lighting so it's more dimly lit. And I know there's definitely tech now. It's been trying to get a lot better. Obviously, you have like ambient occlusion or things like that. Sort of the style they really push for, like Mirror's Edge, which looks really good and was very difficult. But you're starting to see a lot of that more. And then I know with the sharpening of the edge, like Unreal Engine and stuff like that, I've been trying to create basically shadow meshes to try to help create that look. But it's very difficult because it's like if you ever have a strong light on any sort of surface that's popping up, you'll have a very crisp at the very beginning of the origin, and then it very much softens up the further away it gets. And that's just a lot of computing and difficult to pull off tech-wise for games.
Yeah, I saw, I just happened to be reading the Unreal 4.9, Unreal Engine, 3D Engine 4.9 release notes that came out today, I think, or yesterday. And I was just, someone was just like, oh my God, there's so many improvements. I'm like, okay. And just scrolling through, I'm like, wow, they just, that's a lot of stuff for like a 0.9, like they're doing 0.1 every like month or two. And one of the things was like an improved, faster, easier to do way of doing like these area shadows that you're talking about, of like you have some, you know, distant point source like the sun or whatever. And then they have this little example, which I can link in the show notes, of like, okay, we have these columns and the light is coming into this room. And like, if you're being a noob about it, then the columns just make these black strips across the ground. But that's not how the way it looks in life. That's just the way that it's really easy to light the scene in a graphics engine. So
yeah, it's yeah, actually, that's Unreal Engine. That's they've been updating it like crazy all the time. And I guess they had it to where you paid money at the beginning, and then or a subscription, and then finally they removed that once they started putting in the store and making money otherwise. But yeah, they've been able to really keep that engine very competitive. And yeah, they've been trying to make their tech better and better. And it's good because the shadow stuff that you were talking about, remember when I was playing around with that pretty strongly, I guess a few months ago and a year ago, and it was yeah, very slow, and it would work in some situations and not in others. So yeah, it still has a little way, or at least had a little way to go then. But yeah, once you start getting more of that tech being moved along, I've already seen like a huge jump in just lighting tech in the past 5 years. And I think 5 years from now, it's just going to look amazing.
And from what I've heard, that's been the sort of recent history of the cool effects that go into these engines, is that, you know, like you say, they work well in some circumstances and not others. So it's like, wow, this makes a really cool demo. And it's like, oh, but if you have any transparent objects in the scene, or, oh yeah, if you have more than one moving character, then it's like, yeah, then we can't do it in real time or whatever.
And I think transparent objects are still a bit of a problem. Like I'm out of having to implement this stuff anymore, so I haven't been completely up to date on all the research, but I don't think that any of the, like, I don't think there's any technique yet for dealing with translucent objects the same way you deal with opaque objects. Like, it's all, you know, you're always looking at like separate rendering passes and substantially different shading models and stuff like that for translucent objects.
Yeah, I know. I definitely, when it comes to lighting and things like that too, it's and you'll, I guess you'll see, but definitely like with Mirror's Edge, where they just try to hit it with a ton of lighting, and so you can very quickly see what your different options are, because it's just so fast and split second. So even their dark environments are still usually pretty bright. So it's definitely been very important. And you can see a lot of games that can get away with stuff that you couldn't have done before when lighting wasn't that great. And so hopefully we'll be able to see more stuff like that happening. But maybe that's, but I guess as we're talking about, but it's probably, we'll start seeing a lot more faster paced games and new types of games that we couldn't have had just due to lighting, things like that.
It also helps improve the realism of things. If you can do some of that stuff with light, as opposed to something that looks a little more artificial, like it seemed to me, and I mean, I haven't played the new one at all, I've just seen the trailer, but it seemed to me from looking at the trailer of the new Mirror's Edge, that they'd moved away somewhat from the style of the original Mirror's Edge, of having the stuff that you could use very strongly telegraphed with just like, you know, here's an enormous red thing, and so you can run on that. And that this, it was actually a lot more subtle, because I suspect that the lighting had gotten better, that they can sort of draw your eye to this thing in a cleaner way than just making it like glowing red. And that's something I think we've talked about on here before, is sort of the, you know, that level designer trick of like, if you really want someone to go in a particular direction, like putting the brightest light there is always a pretty good way to try and draw them along through the level.
Yeah, as long as it's really contrasting, because you'll also have, I've seen sometimes the opposite, where it'll be like a really bright level. I'm trying to remember which game did this, but it was like, but say like, you know, there's one where it's like a snow planet, and it was just like very bright lighting, and they would try to draw you to where the shadows were. And so you might see like a cave or a rock that's drawing shadows. So sometimes it's just what's the opposite of what's normally you're seeing. But obviously most of the time it ends up being everything's dark, and then you go towards the bright lights. But yeah, it's like almost whichever is contrasting. It definitely seems to bring people right to it. And with Mirror's Edge, they were great at that, where they try to make everything as minimalistic as possible, and then just bring in the tiniest amount of detail would really pop out, and the tiniest amount of like lighting changes or color changes as well, because if everything's red, you put something green there, everyone's going to notice and see where that is. And one of the things is, since you're running through the level so much, or running through all the levels so quickly, you can then be like, okay, I'm in the red room, I just came from the yellow room, so I know where I'm at, but also I can now see that any sort of color changes very easily because everything else is a different color. I think for the new Mirror's Edge, Mirror's Edge 2, they're mostly sticking with white just for the fact that it's like open world and your different lanes, if you're trying to go from point A to point B, could change all the time based on any sort of quests that you gather around. So they don't know what the focal points are that they want you to like look at and go to. So I think they're using like a decal system to where whenever you get a quest to like, I guess, deliver a message, then they're actually like popping down like red graffiti, like red emissive graffiti, to show you the direction of where you're supposed to go. But I know, at least I think they were also talking about an option to where they turn that off. So I think since it's still in pre-alpha, I think they're still trying to figure that one out. But I agree. I actually preferred not using the bright red emissives to show you where to go, just because of the fact that the game is so well polished. A lot of times you don't need such a strong, almost unrealistic looking identifier to help you out. And so the fewer you have of those, the more fun.
In those kind of games where they're pushing you along a path but don't want to make it look like they're pushing you along a path, it's always best if the path doesn't look artificial, right? You always want that, like, the Uncharted series is absolutely fantastic about this, of like you're in some chaotic situation and you're kind of running through it and it feels like you're just running randomly through this thing, but really
it's a tunnel.
You know, if you took any turn other than the exact ones that you take, you'd run smack into a brick wall that would halt your progress. But they pull you at just the right points in the right way. Call of Duty's exactly the same way. Like the single player maps in Call of Duty are just great that way, of like you feel like you could go anywhere, but you can actually go to this one tiny little place, and they just do their hardest to make you not think about going to those other places by making sure that your eye is drawn always to where you want to go. You know, it's like a magic trick, you know, misdirection, a magician making you look at a thing they want you to look at, so you don't notice that all this other stuff over here is a scam.
Whenever the player feels like he's the one who figured it out, like it's so much of a better reward, like you were talking about. So yeah, if they actually figure out how to get to point A to point B and they were directed, but they didn't even notice because they just kept going to where the higher detail was, or however you directed them, they feel so much better. And I even saw that because I've been playing Witcher 3 the past couple weeks. And there was even like this one quest where they had like four different, there's a stage we had to figure out four different, you had to pick between four different objects, and only one of them would save this person from the quest. And it was kind of, you're supposed to figure out based on information that you had heard before, but it was pretty obvious just from me, because they actually put a little tiny light on top of the one that was the correct answer. And so I was like, oh, I'll just go for that, because I know that's it. And sure enough.
Because I'm a level designer. I think that's a really big trade-off that people don't always, especially when these decisions are getting made at the higher executive level or whatever, when they're deciding, okay, we're going to make this game. Okay, we have a team of people that know how to make really great games with good narratives and stuff like that, but now we're going to have them do an MMO, or we're going to have them do a totally open world game where you can do anything. And it's like, okay, that's great. There's a lot of awesome opportunities, but then you suddenly give up a huge set of things in your bag of tricks that allow you to bring across some of that narrative and some of that flow and some of that lead their eye to this certain thing, if you know where they're coming from and where they're going and why they're doing it. If you're standing in this spot in this one area in Call of Duty or Uncharted or whatever, the only reason you'd be standing in this spot is because you're trying to get away from the guys that are behind you, and you're going towards that, you know, hiding house that's up on the hill there. So let's make sure that the hill is above the horizon, and then the little house looks nice and safe in whatever way we want to do that, and you're going to happen to notice it. And sometimes Uncharted goes a little extreme, and like you see the sort of Drake's camera kind of pops up towards the thing, and then he goes, huh, you know, but you know, you can do those little things.
No, Naughty Dog, I mean, they're definitely one of my favorites when it comes to the fact that they can just bring a cinematic experience to video games. I felt like, especially like when you had like an earlier 90s when CD-ROMs came out, you had it to where like, okay, now we can finally make games feel like film. So we'll just throw in little sections of video clips and you choose which video clip decision it goes with and all that stuff. And it was horrible. And then you're finally starting to see where it feels like we're finally getting how to create these great cinematic experiences. And Naughty Dog's been great with it with The Last of Us and Uncharted. And they're even trying to find ways to make it a bit more of what they call like open linear, especially with Uncharted 4, where you get quite a few different choices to get from point A to B, but it still ends up being pretty linear, and they'll still hit you with that really nice cinematic experiences where it's like you see the vista the way they want it to, or it's like you're basically you have that intense moment at the time they want you to, so they can pace it, and so now it's like you're getting this buildup of like it's a giant intense moment. And then it goes down a little bit, and then it's like an even bigger intense moment, and they can control that to where it's just one after the other. And so when you finally hit the climax of the story, it just feels amazing. You have a really hard time getting away with that in open world games. And it's being figured out. We've definitely gotten a lot better at open world games in the past few years. Like you start looking at a lot of stuff, and they'll start creating little micro decisions almost. Like with was it Assassin's Creed? I always call it Pirates of the Caribbean, but it was the
we know the one you mean.
Black Flag, where it's like even when you go onto a boat and you're just trying to go from point A to B, then they started putting out like little loot crates that would pop up, and you have to choose to go right or left if you want to go pick it up. But it's just like they kept giving you decisions along the way because you would just get so disengaged from the game. Like anybody who's played like World of Warcraft or a lot of those MMOs, like once you become like a level 50 and you're running through like maybe a level 5 area or something like that, nothing can hurt you. So you're just going straight from point A to B, and you can bring up like you can start watching TV, you can start like chatting with your friends because you're just bored. You don't have nothing to do in the game.
Yeah, there's nothing can hurt you and nothing can benefit you. There's literally nothing for you. You just somehow screwed up and you need to walk across this crappy noob area. And if you're not in a PvP world, you can't even kill the noobs. So there's nothing.
And so it's like, how do you create that? Like, you want to be able to give the players that like that build up. You want to give them more challenges and increase the intensity along the way. Ways I've been seeing people try to get around this first was with sort of like in Left 4 Dead, where they had the AI director, where it basically watched the group of people, and based on what's been going on, it would hit up like, you know, some new spawns, really raise up the intensity, and then kind of let it cool off for a bit and then start building up to the next big wave. And people have been trying to bring that tech over into open world games. So that way, when you're trying to go out, maybe you spot, you know, a quest that you want to go to. I guess you could see like some of the Fallout series is definitely, or not Fallout, Far Cry series have been doing this, where it's like, okay, I want to get to this next big fort or mission area. And while you're going there, they will hit you with some random quests along the way, where maybe like some enemy convoy starts going by, and you can choose to go after it if you want to, or maybe there's like a drive-by, or maybe some of your allies have their cars been out of commission and they want your help. Those type of things will start spawning along the way, and it will basically kind of check if you've had anything recently. And so it'll try to keep you more engaged even while you're trying to explore and move around. And it used to force that on players, but now it's definitely been getting it to where players can choose if they want to be a part of that or not. And so it's that seems to be becoming more and more popular, I'm saying.
And unless the players are like total obsessive compulsive completionists, which, you know, that's always one of the problems we talked about before with open world design, is you have that, like, if there's stuff that aren't fun, but you can't like constitutionally just let it go because of the kind of person that you are, then oftentimes you don't enjoy that style of game design very much.
Yeah, and it's kind of true with just anything. I'll see this even from level design and things like that. People will put, over here, I want to put some extra cover over here. But then it starts actually bringing down how important just cover is. Like, basically it's like you're trying to create this really fun risk and reward system. And so, yeah, it's like maybe the risk and reward for that little quest that you're talking about is the risk is maybe really small and the reward is really high. And so it just ends up being like, I have to do this to get the gold or get the nice reward, but I don't really enjoy doing it. But the risk is so low, it's just like free money. So I'm just going to go do it anyways. And I'm playing like boring combat or boring traversal quests. So it's like if you keep that stuff away and you really keep it down to like a fewer really well-polished quests or like places of cover or anything where it's just like really good risk and reward and really adds a layer onto the combat or the traversal or wherever it's going on, then you get far more out of it than just like throwing in like everything in the kitchen sink, which I'll see some guys do, and it ends up making it worse. Actually, that was when it was Far Cry 4, I felt like did that. They threw in like helicopters and all sorts of stuff. So now I need to get from point A to B, and before, like in Far Cry 3 or some of the earlier games, it's almost like a little traversal quest. How do I get there? Maybe I have to like go up on this hill, and then I glide over onto that boat, and then I take the boat to get to the next island. But then in Far Cry 4, it's like, okay, let me just go to the nearest helicopter, pop up, and just like beeline it straight to where I'm supposed to go, and then I'm done. So you lose that engagement by just throwing in anything that you think will just add to the game.
I think that's been that in particular, that idea of thinking about traversal and how players get from point A to point B and what how to make that fun is something that's really improved 3D, especially AAA, especially open world style games in the last console generation. Because it used to be like you play Grand Theft Auto or whatever, and like that was kind of almost the beginning of this was like, oh yeah, you can get a car and then you can drive around and you can have fun when you're getting to the next place. But a lot at that era, most of the time, games were like kind of open worldy games were still like, well, eventually you have to walk around a lot, and then eventually maybe you can get a horse, and then you can get around unless the horse dies, in which case you have to walk around along a lot now. And games are more and more getting to, then they were like, okay, well, maybe we could let you fast travel because it's not fun to walk. But then they were like, maybe we could let you like, you know, we get into like superhero games or games like, you know, Batman and stuff like that. We're like, oh, well, you're a superhero. You're awesome. So you should have awesome ways to traverse the environment. And that's when it started being like, okay, actually now it's fun to get around. And that's almost becoming like table stakes for an open worldy game that your character, like, unless for like story reasons, it's just set in real life. Like you're a, you know, a mobster or something like that. And you're just a normal human being. Then you, it's kind of table stakes to be able to get around in an awesome way, like Assassin's Creed or all these other games.
Yeah, it's basically like, especially with open world game, traversal ends up being where people spend more of their time rather than combat. Like obviously like an arena, like Unreal or Quake or things like that. It's like you're constant, Call of Duty, you're just constantly like, maybe it's like a 3 seconds to get into combat. Like it's just like really quick, very small traversal, and then suddenly very heavy amount of time spent in combat. And you get into open world games where it's just so much of the player's experience is all in traversal. So if you don't make that very engaging, you're not going to have a successful game. And you almost have like, you basically have like a feedback loop on players where it's just like the psychology of just like every, people will get bored. And especially in certain markets, especially North American market, where they just need like constant feedback loop of positive reinforcement like all the time. And it's like almost like every second or every 3 seconds, they need to be making like a choice or being given some sort of reward. So that way they're constantly being fed. So that's why you'll see things like in Assassin's Creed with the loot crates that keep popping up along the sides. And it's just like, oh, I chose not to do it to gain some time, or I chose to do it, so I got a little bit of a reward. And the more you can make that engaging and the more people have to think about it to a certain point, you don't want to overload them on choices every other second. But the more you start feeding into that feedback loop, people could lose hours of time and not even notice it. And so it ends up being very difficult to do for traversal sometimes. You have to really think of that stuff ahead of time rather than try to figure that out after you've made all the stuff.
It's interesting. I was playing Grand Theft Auto 5 a while back, and something I sort of noticed with myself with the Grand Theft Auto series, but I really kind of clued in this time, is that one of my first things I always do when I'm playing a GTA game is start collecting motorcycles, because traversing around in the motorcycles is just so much more fun than the car. You know, like the fact that you can A, get there faster, and B, Like, you have this really nimble thing that you can be weaving in and out of traffic. And, you know, like, I run into things and kill myself all the time, but it's way more fun. Whereas the cars, it's like, oh, okay, I gotta drive the car there. It's gonna take me, like, 50% longer than if I had my motorcycle, and I can't just drive like a crazy person because I can't squeeze in between any piece of traffic that I'm going to encounter when I'm going double the speed of them.
That's exactly what I did with GTA 3, like Vice City. Like, I remember just getting in a motorcycle, and I played that game forever after I basically did all the content. I finally just did that, and I would just get in giant police chase to see how long I could go before I could basically kill myself, or basically till I die. And then finally got to the point where I just would never die, and I'm like, well, I guess I'm done with the game. I mean, once you get good enough at the motorcycle, and there's just it was such a fun risk reward system, and the skill of learning how to do it. And if you ever made a mistake, it was basically over. And so finally, once it got to the point where you're so good that now there's no risk anymore, then suddenly it's just like, okay, I'm done with the game. The challenge feels over, and I don't feel that engagement and the reward anymore. So and the motorcycle was great for that.
Yeah, that's a problem in any game, and in general, people will enjoy it the easier you make it until they get kind of maximum good at it, and then they enjoy it zero.
Yeah.
So it's like, we always say so at PAX, I was going around trying all these indie games, and they're all so freaking hard. Like, this is just the cool thing to do to make your indie game really hard. And not every single one of them, there was a few, but there's kind of a tendency to make them really hard, but that's really beneficial if you're an indie developer and you don't have a lot of budget to design 100 levels or all these skill trees and let the game get more and more complicated. If, you know, it takes a while for someone to master each stage, each level of difficulty, each, all these sort of things, then you get more sort of benefit for your work on that section
Difficulty is very hard to balance for, obviously. So usually you want to have a lot of play tests or things of that sort to kind of figure it out. But yeah, I'll definitely see some games where it's just like, it's a really great game, but because it requires so much energy right at the very beginning to learn how to play or to get enough skills to be able to actually make it through some of the game to get some of those rewards for that feedback loop we were talking about. And people will just leave it because there's just too much energy to get into it. And so usually what I'll try to see, I've heard some game companies call it, they'll try to create a player funnel. Basically try to have it to where it's just a whole lot of people can get started, and then finally we can start funneling them down to the heavier stuff and the things that require more skill and more time investment to get into, and to the point where it's they're really deep into the game and very invested to where they won't leave right away.
Yeah, especially important for an MMO or free play type game, that it's okay, we're just gonna have a lot of people trying this, and then kind of the majority of people who are playing at any given time are sort of not hardcore about it, but they're and they play it sometimes or whatever, but there's always gonna be some people that are just on the forums excuse me, I was doing this raid that you released yesterday, and I already beat it, this game is a waste of my whatever a month because I've only played 8,000 hours, and
Yeah, it's always fun to see people that are just no one ever played this, and it's I played 600 hours in this game. It's I feel you're done at that point, or for some people. And yeah, you want to, we were talking about before, it's if you want to make a game last for a long time, especially with the free-to-play games and things like that, like MMOs, where you want to keep them in the community and keep them going once new games come, or I guess new expansions come out. You definitely want to somehow have it to where the difficulty will keep increasing along the way, to where even when they get to the cap, they can still get that fun risk and reward setup going. So yeah, you definitely want to make a game that doesn't destroy your risk and reward, but so it keeps on somehow getting more difficult. And that ends up being very, it's not easy to do. You have to usually keep on adding content or to somehow design for that ahead of time. And yeah, it's definitely a challenge.
I think, back to what we were originally talking about of competitive multiplayer games, competitive multiplayer games always do that to some degree by having the individual levels be so heavily polished and everything so well balanced in the best multiplayer levels that, as long as you've got interesting opponents, there's always something new and interesting and different, or some skill challenge that needs to be executed perfectly every time, something that you can just keep replaying that that same content because so much effort's just been put into polishing the one thing.
Yeah, PvP games definitely seem to have the most longevity, and definitely my favorite type of games as well. And like you're right, there's when it comes to making the level, for me, it feels like I'm just having to make like a giant like chessboard. And so players can go in, and based on who they're playing up against, it could go very differently. And that's why it lives forever for them, just because every time they go in, they can test their skills. And if they're testing their skills against another high-skill player, then that usually ends up being very engaging to them. And you also have it to where some people just really enjoy almost just dominating other players too. So if they're going up against
somebody... some people.
Maybe me too. If they're going up against somebody with like a lower skill level, then they feel that great reward for all the time they've spent into the game getting their skills up higher. They're now like, you know, destroying these players, and they feel the reward for doing that. So they'll usually end up doing that for quite a bit too. And the only time it ends up being hard, and I'll still see some players that will do this, but once you start going up, it's people that are always much higher skill level than you, then a lot of times that pushes people out. Like I'll see that happen with like some of the games like StarCraft or LoL or things like League of Legends, where people will go in and it's just like it ends up being too much to learn at the very beginning, and they're going against very players who've been playing this quite a bit, and they're just putting in to learn to get new champions and stuff. And so it ends up being very hard for new players, and because of that difficulty level, they'll quit. But you also have it to where, for on the other side of things, the people who are winning all the time definitely want to love that, or enjoy that feedback of just dominating other players. But you also have it to the psychology where some of those players will see the dominating players out there, and you want to kind of feed them that every once in a while, so they'll see that and be like, I want to have that experience. And so then they will invest a ton of time. And if it's a free-to-play style game, they'll invest a ton of money as well sometimes to then get to that stage to where they get the that dominating experience that they saw that the other player had. Yeah, it's interesting, that whole, I guess, that back and forth. And I'll see companies that will actually try to figure that out to a science on how to... And you'll see that even in some of the matchmakers that they do for some of the games that you queue up for, they'll throw in some like high skilled players just to kind of create that situation.
Yeah, that's the thing with it that always makes that the best experience that can be, is if you've got a team game, you can balance the teams even if you're not individually balanced against every single player on the other team, right? You don't have to be better than the best player on the team. You only have to be better than the player on the other team who's in the same skill ordering as you are. You know, if you're the fourth best player on your team and you're better than the fourth best player on their team, then you can positively contribute, right?
Yeah,
that's something I've noticed with Destiny, as now that I'm getting good enough that I can actually contribute to my team, that I'll have games where I'll play through it and I'm like, wow, I kicked ass. And then at the end of it, it's like, oh, I was actually the worst player on the team, but I was just on a really good team and they were keeping anyone from killing me, so I was staying alive and getting my normal amount of kills. And I've played other games where I'm like, wow, I kicked ass. And I look at him like, wow, I totally carried my team. Who the hell were these people? They didn't kill anyone, you know? And so you can work either way, but because the teams end up being relatively balanced and like it just does it the same way StarCraft does, and kind of just the standard way that it's done now, which is just they do the balancing as well as they can, but they try to just keep everyone's win rate at 50%. So if you lose three in a row, then it's like, okay, man, this guy needs a win because it's just sucking for him. So
there's another way I'll see, and this is kind of true with any game type, but a lot of ways to get people to where they still feel like they're contributing, which is definitely extremely important with team-based games, is to give them other objectives and give them rewards for those objectives. So like in like Battlefield, you can spot enemy players and that will give you a little bonus like XP or reward for it. And they'll even a lot of times like show that in the stats at the end of the game. And so you can kind of see who's been contributing to the team, because you might have it to where obviously everyone gets to see the kills that some of the people did, but you might have it to where some people were just like playing support and they want to be able to have it to where people can see them on the leaderboards and basically get their reward for the fact that they played support and they had all these other little objectives of maybe they went and captured the point while everyone else was killing, or they went and, you know, maybe handed out a lot of ammo or health. And so any way to like really reward them for smaller objectives, if maybe they try to go in and kill people and we're just getting owned by higher skill level players, and like, well, I can go do this other little objective that I know I can do and get my reward for it. And
I caused a problem with that when for the very first playing Destiny, and I was like playing, I was just getting destroyed to the point where that most games I would get zero kills and then I would get no credit for having played, because even if you play, I did plenty of damage, like, but I got killed every time before I killed anyone. I would occasionally kill someone with a rocket if I was lucky enough to pick up a rocket or something. But what I saw is I'd play this control match and they would give you bonus points to your team that I guess would be associated with you if you capture a control point. So I was like, okay, I'm going to capture as many control points as I can. Yes. And that's all I'm going to do is capture control points. But at least the way the maps are in Destiny, like, you want to capture two of the 3 points and then hold them, and some of the points suck. And also, if you capture a point and then get killed and then they capture it back, then you just gave them points and the points for killing you. So I was like feeding the opponent team and like screwing up my team. And and then once I started playing with people with headsets, they're like, dude, stop doing that. And I'm like, oh yeah, you're right, that they don't really even give you that many points for controlling a point. And they're like, yes, just kill people or don't die, like, yeah, that's more important.
And I definitely consider that bad design. And I would see that with League of Legends as well, where they're even known for how toxic their community is. And they've put time into like trying to figure out ways to fix this by like creating like a sort of like jury system and all sorts of stuff. And it hasn't really fixed the problem. And so much of it comes down to the fact that once a lower skill level player is there, or a player that's losing on your team, he's feeding the other team, and the other team is bigger or doing better because of it. And once you start having that sort of design set up and not allowing the higher skilled players or any other players of the team to find a way to mitigate that, then you start having a very toxic relationship of people with inside the team for that reason. So yeah, it's you definitely want to make sure to not sort of create that toxicity, and then also to find ways to create rewards that won't make it unbalanced for one team over the other, or at least to allow options to where they can somehow almost outflank those options. I'll see that with like Hearthstone, when they've tried to come out with some of their stuff, they'll have it to where they kind of center their gameplay more on the objectives in the map, more so than killing enemy players. And so you don't have as much of that toxic atmosphere.
You're talking about Heroes of the Storm.
Heroes of the Storm. I get Hearthstone and Heroes of the Storm always mixed up name-wise. Yeah,
Blizzard has even made fun of those because they have Hearthstone, Heroes of Warcraft, and then Heroes of the Storm, which is partially Warcraft characters, and I think there's also a Hearthstone object in that game. Yeah, they are not very good at naming things. And
yo, dog, I heard you liked Hearthstone.
Yeah, exactly. But I think they seem to be financially doing okay. With
not too bad, yeah.
Yeah, so to kind of do one last thing on our sort of level design sort of topic. One thing that I thought was interesting, just because it's a thing that everyone's encountered and often people will just like complain about it, but they don't really understand how it comes about, is this thing of invisible walls. And I'm sure both of you have like stories of invisible walls that ended up being necessary, or that you thought people wouldn't run into, but they did, or whatever. But I thought that was kind of a fun thing to touch on, or just an interesting quirk to touch on. Like, what are some of the things that you can do to avoid, other than the sort of thing that actually has become quite popular, which is make your level an island?
That seems to be like almost everyone's first map when they make one. It seems to be an island, because you don't have to worry about any of that. On when I worked on Firefall, that was they kind of knew that was going to be an issue, especially with open world. So they ended up actually creating a narrative and gameplay to kind of support what the boundary was. Like, they actually created what they called like the melding, and it was almost like this storm entity. And so if you ever went into it, it would hurt you over time and kill you. And you also had creatures that could come out of it, and so you could have it. You actually had certain gameplays where you, and the quest, you go and you capture Repulsor, you push back the melding, and then suddenly you unlock this new area. And so that's how we could control the walls or the boundaries. I've definitely seen, like with Far Cry and a lot of the other open world games, they'll usually have it to where it's like they let you know if you have a few seconds, and then they'll either forcefully bring you back or they'll kill you. And things like that, where it's just like, I call it a fatigue volume, but basically you start going out there and you can't keep going any further. And that's usually by like a certain amount of time. But for invisible walls, like when you have to keep a player within a small space, it's always, I find, the hardest in cities, just because of the fact you're normally a lot of times dealing with very flat terrain and obviously very huge structures. And it's like, how do you clog up every single street and make that work?
It's hard if you're not in a post-apocalyptic environment. Like, yeah. You know, when you're doing like The Last of Us or something like that, it's just like, all right, well, there was a whole bunch of like buses stopped running right on this intersection, so you can't go through it, and that's fine. But if it's like, hey, this is a normal, modern, functioning city that you're running through there, having your firefight with a terrorist, it's like, okay, how come every corner I turn, there's like a bus parked right across the road? Definitely buses are a huge one in, you know, in any game set in a city. It'll just be like, yep, some bus just ran out of gas, like right across that intersection.
And then it hit on the e-brake and slid sideways to block the entire road. Yeah.
Or just like the, like, you know, Les Miserables barricade style of just like everyone just piled everything they could get, like just in a big pile in the middle of the street.
Yeah, you definitely see that with like a Crisis or Crisis 2 or things like that, where it's like in the city and they had to put up like quarantine walls and all sorts of stuff. And that's what it ends up being. It's mostly just you have to create and I'll do this before I start any map. I'll try to gather, I call it like narrative resources, but basically try to figure out as much story elements as possible to really tie people into the environment. And it also gives me more resources to pull from when I'm having to do things like that, of just like, I have to block off this area, but since there's a strong enough story to go off of, I can actually go through, like, maybe this place, there's, like, some rubble here, or maybe, yeah, it's, like, maybe there's a virus, so we're quarantining it, or maybe it's, like, Last of Us, so it's eroded because it's been here long enough. I find the more you study into creating a stronger narrative for an area, and definitely a more unique narrative, it gives you far more pieces to pull off of. So that's what you should do.
One of the things I always appreciate is, even when I hit the invisible walls, if the invisible wall is something more clever than an actual invisible wall, like a couple months ago, or I guess not even, maybe even a month ago, I played through Journey again because it just got released on the PS4. I'd already bought it on the PS3, and so downloaded it, played through it, and I said, all right, well, I'm going to go and get my white robes and collect all the little floaty, glowy bits. And so, you know, there's a couple of levels you have to do a pretty careful exploration of to find all those, and I discovered, which I'd never had before because I hadn't encountered it before, that Journey has invisible walls all over the place, and what the invisible walls are is they're just a sandstorm that pushes you back if you walk too far, which when I first ran into that, I'm like, okay, that's pretty clever. Like, it's obviously just an invisible wall from a, you know, mechanical standpoint, but it's a invisible wall that fits in so beautifully with the game. Another one that I really like, which I know there have been a couple games that do it. I think one of the GTA games did it, is just having some like monster that'll basically completely eat you. Like, I think there's one of the, like the first GTA game that you could go in the water in, maybe GTA 3, Vice City, maybe. Anyways, there was one of them that you could go in the water and swim. And I don't know if there were any boats yet or something like that, but anyways, if you swam far enough out, a shark would eat you. Like, you'd just be swimming along, and like a shark would just come in and just like full on, like, yeah, just chomp you, and that was the end.
That seems to be really popular, because obviously with like creating walls and things like that, it's very easy when you got like really big collisions. So it's like if you're out in like in a forest, all you do is just sort of like raise up a little tiny cliff or plateau so players can't get onto it, kind of thing. And it's very obvious of just like, I can't go there. A lot of times you want to really open up an area, like what was it with Borderlands? Sometimes they would have like an open area and they would have it to where there might be old sentry guns that would activate and try to shoot you, or that it'd be like a minefield out there. So if you went out there, you would die. Sort of like with the shark, with Crisis, I remember the first one, like you start off where they actually like helo drop you out into the water, and they basically very much direct you down one way. But if you swim around the island and try to go off to the sides, you'll actually see like they had like North Korean like battleships or something, and they would actually launch missiles to come kill you if you went too far into that zone. So So yeah, it's almost like you have to create like a, it's sometimes, especially for open areas without a physical object there, you have to be very creative and a lot of times try to make it stick to whatever the story is, and that makes it stronger.
Well, that's a lot better than what Destiny does, which is that if you boost over a wall or something that you're not supposed to go to, it just has a little message that says turn back, and then it goes 3, 2, 1, block, and then just die spontaneously for no story reason that just decides, oh, on the other side of the wall.
Yeah, even if you're going to do that, you can do it better in the story. Like Assassin's Creed just has the ridiculous, like, glowing walls, but at least they make some basic effort to tie into the world fiction.
Yeah, the simulator that you're plugged into doesn't have that data.
Because it's like you have like that memory, right? So you're playing within the memory, and it's like, oh, you're going outside of the limits of your memory right now. We haven't unlocked that part of your memory yet. So your old, I guess, ancestor had never been to that city yet, so you can't go there.
I think that's quite a clever way of dealing with that. Awesome. So thanks a lot, Bobby, for coming and doing this with us. Where can people find more about what you're up to and what you're doing?
I usually try to keep my tutorials on my website, bobbyross.com. You can see like my portfolio and stuff like that. But I'll also try to sometimes send stuff out to Gamma Sutra, and I've also been talking with like Extra Credits. Hopefully you can just go to my website, and hopefully some of the infographics might be helpful to you.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We always want to know what you think about the show. So you can follow us. You can follow the show on Twitter at UpUpShow. Find me as APike, and Nigel is at Nigel Brook. Leave us a review. Let us know what you think. And see you next week. So how do you enjoy PAX?
No, PAX was great. Actually, we had like a wargaming party last night, and it lasted till like 2:30 in the morning. And then I was at PAX all day today, and so that's why you probably see me drinking so much water, because I am probably insanely dehydrated from like the whole past 24 hours.
Yeah, I saw the giant wargaming booth. As it happened, the first thing I did when I got into PAX after being like slightly mind melted having a giant 8-foot-tall Master Chief cosplayer sneak up behind me and startle me. But after I did that, it was awesome. Like cosplay, I'm like, oh yeah, that's cool. But I don't know how they found this guy, or I don't know if. I assumed the costume was so good. I assumed it was like an official Microsoft, Microsoft probably. Sponsored Master Chief, because this guy was like at least a foot taller than anyone else in the area. Anyway, the first thing I did was I got into the line for the Project Morpheus VR demo from Sony, because I've been quite curious, like how much can a PS4 really drive a VR headset? So I was kind of wanting to check that out. But that line, which was more than an hour long, went all the way along the wall facing the giant screens for the wargaming booth. So I've seen every video in that loop, which actually, like, there's quite a few. A lot of them just play like one trailer over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh yeah, we got this game, we got this game, we got this game. So I know all about World of Tanks now.
Nice. Yeah, you might have seen more videos than I have at that point.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, especially because I've had a study a lot on like World of Tanks and stuff like that, but World of Warships, it's still been kind of I guess now they're in beta, and I think, and it looks like a really fun game. I can't wait to play it, but I've been kind of waiting more for them to actually sort of like release it, so I don't have to worry about the bugs, and I can tell some of the mechanics they plan on changing. And so, but from the little bit that I've seen and played, it's definitely a really fun game. Wargaming also did like World of Warplanes. I didn't enjoy that as much, especially as a level designer. Every single level in that game is basically just air level. Like it's
the sky does not have a lot of chest high walls in it for you to lay out.
No. And then one of the great things about levels is that it forces you to react, you can have a lot of control and a ton of fun with the player. But when it's just like you're up in the air, it's like, okay, I'm going to go here, and then I'm going to do this strategy that I do every single time. And it doesn't really force you to change any of your tactics or give you much of the way of tactics to use. And so, yeah, the World of Warplanes thing wasn't as fun, but at least with World of Tanks and battleships, warships, you definitely get a lot more of that engagement to it.
Yeah. Any other games that you play that you're excited about? You get a chance to try any of the booths?
Oh my gosh. I was really happy to see, I guess it was the Xbox booth. They had Mirror's Edge 2 pre-alpha set up.
Oh, cool.
And so I got to finally try that out some. And I'm a huge fan of Star Wars and Star Wars Battlefront. Was over at the
that looks so PS4 good. Booth. Oh, yes. Man.
Lighting, everything. It's just the animations and the way things worked. It looked so much fun.
Did you see a demo, or did you get a chance to try it?
I was standing behind the people that were playing and just watching them, because there's just so much fun to nerd out on. And
oh yeah,
yeah. There was also, I'm a huge fan of like Orcs Must Die, and they were showing off. I guess they're even having tournaments for it, but they were they've now turned like Orcs Must Die into more like a MOBA style game, and so I'm really curious how that's gonna go.
I hadn't seen this before. It was like, this game has like a 10 out of 10 score, and apparently everyone loves Orcs Must Die. What's the idea?
It's basically like a third person tower defense.
Okay.
But it's like very deep gameplay. And then when they released the second one, it introduced co-op. It's a really fun, it's what I a lot of times use as a great example of good game design. Because of the fact that they minimized a lot of their stuff and then just made it very polished. They're just like, here's what we're doing. And they didn't go overboard. And all of the choices that you get for like traps and the creatures that you're going up against and how they release the waves was very created very deep gameplay. And the way they rewarded you as well for certain combos and things of that sort. So you were always trying, you always could do better. Oh, and they had like leaderboards. So you could always see how your friends did as well. So like basically you saw how they did in a certain match and or a certain level, so you might go back to the level to get more points just to do better than them, and it will let them know. So it created it was still very social and competitive, even though it was almost like a single player or co-op tower defense game.
Okay, cool. I should put that on my list. A bunch of things got added to my list. I spent some time at the Darkest Dungeon booth playing the game. That's a indie game, but it's like one of those, like, I don't know if you want to call it double A indie or whatever
people
refer to it as, like six people as opposed to one person. They've been working on it for multiple years. They are like veterans of the game industry, pretty polished indie game without a lot of scopes. So it's like 2D, but it's a sort of roguelike dungeon crawler party based game. So it's roguelike in that dying and losing is and random generation is part of it, but you get a team of five people, and that you recruit new people, and those people die and they get upgraded and stuff like that, and then you get pit against things that are possibly too difficult, and then you have to make this choice, like choices like, do you run or do you keep fighting and stuff like that. So
nice.
It was quite cool, they're showing off their new stuff, and it's very polished for what it is. It has like a 2D illustrative sort of art style, but they've done some cool things with the way that it sort of feels mixed up, and the animation stuff kind of does a good balance. Like, it's hard to animate sort of 2D characters in a way that, like, you don't even know how they're going to get animated when you start, but it's cool. And I had some good chats with the dev team there, so hopefully we'll get some of them on the show.
I guess it's almost like, yeah, successful indie companies versus like some of the ones that are still trying to like get started. And so it's like it's become to the point where they're getting longer and longer lines on seeing it packs than they used to. And it's really fun to see more of this focus on some of these like successful, or I guess just on indie games in particular. And thanks to like definitely Kickstarter and I guess like Greenlight and just digital distribution on its own, you have so many of these indie companies that are just on the rise. And a lot of these AAA companies kind of going down a bit because of it. And that's been a lot of fun.
That's actually mainly what I've been playing the last little while is indie games. When I got my PS4 at the beginning of the year, I started just basically downloading like all of the free PSN games, just because like, what the hell, they're free, right? And the last little while, like, there's been a pretty good run on reasonable games on that I've actually kind of enjoyed playing. And then like a couple ones I sort of had my eye on either were released or got price drops. So like, I just finished Limbo finally, like day before yesterday, and I played Road Not Taken by previous guest Dan Cook, which was still, I think, still in beta when we had him on, but is now out. And yeah, it's nice. It's like, it just feels like less of a commitment in a lot of ways for, you know, for those indie games. You know, you're only paying like $10 for them and polish them off in a couple of days. And you know, if you don't turn out to like them, you don't feel like you've really wasted anything on them. But there's some just like amazing gems there that are, you know, worth as much gameplay wise as like a $60 AAA game. So
yeah, it's kind of too bad, because I know with like even with AAA games, they like with Alien Isolation, I don't know if any of you guys played that, but it was a really good game, but it just went on for like way too long. I felt like it was almost like three acts. It was like the first act where you're going up against the one alien, and then finally when you deal with it, then it was just like, it felt like it's like, okay, I'm done. Like, this was a good game, I'm done. And then suddenly it's like, oh, now I gotta go back, and then you have to deal with like the droids, or and then finally have to deal with the whole nest of aliens, and it's just like you're just kind of done with it at that point. So if they could have just ended the game right there at that first part and then created expansions for it afterwards, I would have totally loved it way more. But the fact that you could tell, it's like, okay, we need to put out like this $60 game. We can't just put out like, you know, like 9 hours of content or anything like that. It's got to be closer to 60 hours or however long.
I'm interested in what they're doing with the new Hitman game, because they're kind of like doing sort of what you're suggesting there of it being more like an episodic release. Like you buy the game, but you don't get all of the levels right out of the gate. Like basically they're going to have some chunk of the content and then they'll sort of be releasing more. And that's just like an explicit part of the game from right up front, is like you're paying your $60 or $70, whatever it is. And you're not getting the entire game right now. You're getting the rest of it as like episodic DLC content. And for something like Hitman in particular, where when there's plot at all between the missions, it's only of the most tenuous form.
Yeah.
And like basically like it's just all about like, here's this environment, here's your target, you know, spend an hour to 3 hours just like learning everything about this level and figuring out your way around it and you know, and execute the guy, and then, you know, then you'll go on to some other completely different location with no continuity and do the same thing again. And so doing like, you know, doing that kind of episodic release, I think could benefit a game like that.
Yeah. It's like, you almost have to, if you're really smart, you can just like, yeah, design it ahead of time, make it modular, make sure you design a modular game. So that way you could just kind of break it off into pieces. Sort of like, yeah, Telltale does. And it sounds, that's awesome that Hitman's doing it too. Cause yeah, it's like basically somebody wants to go in there, basically solve this, you know, grand puzzle, and then they're kind of done. Like you can just, and if they feel like doing another puzzle, then give them that. And so it's really cool that they actually can section that off, because it's so modular. It's actually a pretty good setup.
It's interesting how being able to give people that sense of completion from each episode can really change the way people feel about the game. Like I played the Telltale Walking Dead. I think I bought all 5 episodes as a pack, but I'd only play, I think I've only played 1 or 2, maybe to the first 2 of them. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel resentful for having to have abandoned the game, because I felt like I played 2 games and enjoyed them both. And maybe I'll go play the other ones. It's nice that I own them. But playing the second one, it's like, all right, I got to an end point, and it's like, da-da, and then the theme music played or whatever. I got to the end of the episode, right? It didn't feel like, it was just at a checkpoint and my guy was just standing there, and I was like, well, I guess I'll turn it off and then feel bad for not coming back to it.
No, it works with like TV too, where it's like sometimes some of my favorite TV shows are the ones where it's just like, it has its own little story arc in the episode, and by the time it's over, I felt good, but sometimes it's obviously like, it'll give you a hint or something of a much larger story arc, so once all the episodes are pieced together, then you get that great sense of completion of an entire story arc. While instead you have a lot of like I guess like anime and like 24 and some of those, where it's just like once you watch the end of the episode, then it's a giant cliffhanger or a teaser to the next one. So you never feel that sense of completion. You have to keep going until
even
it's
if
all
you don't
over.
Want to.
Yeah. Yeah, with 24, I would just stop it like halfway, which felt like the end of an actual episode, and then I get started the next half once the next episode came out, and I just kept doing that, and I was like, okay.
Game in the system.
Yeah.
That's an incredibly clever technique for watching those kinds of shows.
That's good.
Oh, for some of my favorite stuff I saw at PAX, or at least definitely on the indie side, there was this guy, I'm pretty sure the game was called Kingdom. Like, he only had it on like a couple computer screens. It was sort of like a side-scrolling pixel art game, and
There's something you don't see much of these days.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Was it like a platformer? I haven't seen any of those.
And it was basically you're like a king of an area, and you have this whole living environment behind you of just like people with different professions, and you could go and basically tax them to get money, and then you can redistribute that wealth somewhere else. And it ended up being like you could then start giving maybe like the blacksmith more money, and then he could start building up his own little area, and then he might be able to protect himself from maybe like raids or things of that sort. So then he starts putting maybe like a little town gets created, and they start chopping away lumber or taking lumber, and then that ends up actually sort of feeding this other business. And then once he has enough set up, then he might actually, you know, they have like their own little town, and ends up being like maybe it starts destroying other people's business and pushing them out or creating these big feuds or things like that. So you're like helping feed this environment. It's just like you're just taking money and throwing money, and you're trying to like create this whole little I guess like feudal like town and stuff like that. But it starts creating almost no matter what you will end up doing, will start creating problems for somebody else or in some other unique way. So it was almost like a puzzle on like how you figure this out. And it almost felt like more like what you actually have to deal with in a political situation, or I guess as an actual king. And it felt really cool. And the art style, though it was pixely, still had a really nice animation to it, to where it felt really good too.
Huh, that's cool. I hadn't heard of that. I don't think it was in the, or I didn't notice it in the mega booth.
It was like pretty well hidden, and it's kind of too bad because I actually thought it was pretty good. But I think it's just the, you know, it's like one person making it, so he's got to like, you know, show it off and everything like that. And so yeah, it can be really hard for especially the one person devs that have to like market it and do everything else on top of the development and the art and everything. So I'd see a few of those guys that just like had maybe like one computer or one little station, and don't even have like some of the bigger backdrops that a lot of the other guys do, especially because sometimes when you don't have like much of any money, it can be pretty expensive to like try to print out some of the banners that a lot of the other guys, you know, will have like giant, especially like, yeah, World of Tanks, they have giant ones everywhere.
The World of Tanks booth was like ridiculous, giant things hanging from the ceiling. Like, I don't think they literally had a tank, but like that's the level of like degree they went to.
It was huge. I mean, usually you have like, I guess like one booth, even one booth can be pretty big. Theirs was like, I guess like four of those big booths combined basically. And
yeah, it was like the size of the PlayStation booth. Yeah, those little, even in the, because in my mind, this is the first PEX I'd actually been to, even though it's just down in Seattle, but I just keep being like, oh, I need want to go, but it's so close to other conferences that I kept not being able to. But this year, I was glad that I went, and one of the things I had in mind, there's lots of reasons I went, you know, meet some people, maybe come on the show, learn some stuff, play some games, obviously. But one of the things I had in mind is I'm working on this little side project game that I, you know, have been having fun with, and I was like, oh, what would be involved in presenting that in, like, the indie booth? And then actually seeing how much goes into like some of those indie booths, they're like way more sophisticated than your average just normal conference booth. Like if you go to like an oil industry conference where they have like tons and tons of money and they just go to the average booth, it's just like a guy with a table and a black nerd on the table.
And PAX is pretty low key comparatively. Like, yeah, you look at E3 and all that stuff, and it just feels like it almost alienates everybody else because of the amount of production that has to go into it. So it's interesting to see PAX try to fight that in a way. It's like they have to accept some of that. You can definitely see some of the like where they try to still support more indies, the guys. Because whenever you start having those really big, highly produced booths, then it just draws everybody like a magnet to those. And they're built to be able to hold on to people as much as possible and to go through as many people as possible. And then you have these other guys that are just like, I don't even have, you know, the time or the money to go build and design a banner. And I basically don't have enough money to like, you know, $10,000 to throw down on a booth. So I get kind of put off into a little tiny section that's just like hard to find. And so it's still hard to support all of those people.
Well, inside the, so they have the main show and then there's like all the big booths. And then inside the, that there's this like booth, which I think is probably the footprint of four booths, maybe, of the main show, that is the indie mega booth, where they have these little sub booths. They're about the size, closer to the size of like a normal boring expo size booths. But then inside the mega booth, they have the indie mini booth, where they just have these stands with TVs, and then there's like four games all kind of presenting all back to back each other. And like, that's the scale that I could do. I could definitely be someone who goes and puts my game on a PC that they provide for you, and I stand there for 8 hours and I talk about it, and I put up like a little banner at the top that's like, you know, the size of 5 A4 pieces of paper. Like, that's an easy thing to do. But once you start to get one of these booths, especially, you don't see a lot of indie racing games. So there's one called Distance that I got a chance to play, that's like quite high production value. And they had this crazy booth with glowing neon lights and flashing things and car arcade stuff and like a car with a driving thing and like bouncing music. Like, I think some of the indies in there were like, come on, guys. Yeah. Like, that's not the indie way. Like, you're pushing it.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty obvious because, yeah, it's like, yeah, you had like all these booths with some of the games, and there's just like bright red LEDs blinking everywhere. And it was just like, look at me. And it was like, okay, that's a little too much.
Just, maybe just get an actual booth if you're going to be like that.
It's bad booth babes, but they can't ban electricity. So let's pump as much electricity through this booth as we possibly can to attract people's attention.
Yeah, just gotta level design yourself. Yeah, just like all the stuff we talked about. Just like put a giant red, like bright red light emissive on it, and that will look have everybody look right at it.
It worked. Yeah. And actually, I was, so when I saw the game, I was like, oh, actually, I would like that. It was like a Rush kind of game where your car can fly, and it was cool.
Yeah, it could be that there was like all sorts of other indie racing games there, but just none of them had big glowing spinning lights on their booth, so you didn't find any of them. That one.
No, actually, the indie mega booth or whatever, I love that, because since they were all so much back-to-back and right next to each other, I was just, like, walking around, and suddenly I felt like I got to see, like, 15 games in just, like, 5 minutes, and I just, like, pulled so many cards of the ones I really liked, just to go check them out later. So actually, that was really nice.
The two that I would point out of ones I thought was interesting that are in early access if people are interested in checking out that I had fun playing with at the Mega Booth. One was called Mini Metro, which really gets to my, like, sort of one of the types of games I love, which is kind of like a minimalist simulation game. And it looks like if you've ever seen like the London Tube map or any of the sort of minimalistic transit maps, but then you just draw out the lines and then people are trying to get from place to place. And it's very kind of cool. Like if you like those sort of set on your, I played it on the iPad, although it's on early access on PC and Mac, I think, right now. But it plays well on the iPad, apparently. But they were all saying, oh, it's not as good on the iPad as it is on the PC. So I don't know. But I had fun just kind of like dragging around. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to connect these two things. Oh, there's too many people who want to go to Square. And I like make another line that goes to Square and stuff. And it was just fun, a nice little minimalistic thing.
Yeah. Did you see the Bomb Diffuse game that they had? It's like Oculus Rift one.
No. Oh yeah, it was like keep talking and nobody blows up or something.
It was like I think you had like 5 minutes to figure out how to defuse this bomb, and the bomb would change every time you played it. And then so that person who's trying to defuse the bomb, he's wearing the Oculus Rift, and so he's the only one that can see the bomb. And then he's basically having to talk to a buddy, and they actually had like a, I guess like a binder with all like on how to defuse the bomb, and you would have his buddy would have to explain to him what's going on, and the guy would have to like find out what it is.
Cut the red wire.
Yeah, it's like the slight, you know.
So awesome.
It looked really cool, and even the binder itself was very confusing. So it was made to be like a puzzle for both of them to figure out. It's like, how do I describe this? And the other guy's like, it'd basically be like, okay, press the one button on it, and it's like, okay, I press the one, and then all the numbers change. He's like, ah, and they have to explain all the stuff that's going on. And so it was interesting. It was a very different puzzle for each one of them. And I was talking to one of the devs while I was watching it, and because it felt so much, I don't know if you ever watched like the show Archer. Where they're like trying to defuse a bomb, and they both get really confused, and it ends up like creating this really funny dialogue. And that's actually what inspired them to make this game.
Oh, really?
And it was definitely the most unique Oculus Rift game that I've seen. It was definitely a lot of fun to watch, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the person who's in the Oculus Rift like knows there's no really real bomb, but they don't want it to explode. They're getting a little testy. And the person who's reading the book, I'm sure, is like, no, it'll be fine. They're like, it's not fine, it's going to
bomb. It's like, it's four, three, it's like, it's like, and we're dead. No, it's fun because, yeah, it'll create that, like, tense moments. I felt like they could have even pushed that more if they wanted to. But yeah, that definitely adding any time onto anything will definitely always add intensity to whatever it is.
There's something cool about that kind of like asymmetric game design, you know, like that's something that I think is becoming a little more in vogue in kind of an interesting way. Like, you know, there's games on the Wii U with the having the gamepad and the main screen that have that same sort of thing. And, you know, there's a few like just radically asymmetric games there. Like, I don't know if either of you guys saw Spy Party there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's one of those games that I've been like keeping an eye on because it really interests me because it's like, here's two people that are playing totally different games at the same time, but you have to, you know, you have to somehow make it that it's a fair contest between them, even though they're not even like they're using completely different mechanics and, you know, different skills and everything's just completely different about the experiences. But, you know, ideally, if the two people have the same skill, you want it to be a fair game. And, you know, that's just hard to do, but it's really interesting when it works.
Oh, yeah. Especially in multiplayer games. I've been seeing a lot of people trying to figure that out, too, with, like, Evolve, where it's, like, one is the boss monster and the other four are trying to take him down. And then did you ever see the Dungeons & Dragons booth that they put out?
I saw it, but I it looked like they were running, like, an actual, like, it was a game. It wasn't the tabletop stuff.
Yeah, it was, it's kind of like, sort of like Neverwinter Nights or things like that, which obviously was, you know, trying to give that Dungeons & Dragons feel to video games, where you have one person as the dungeon master, and he actually has certain abilities where he can, like, spawn creatures or things of that sort and throw them at the adventurers, and there's four players that are going through the quest. And it was actually, because I've made a mod on this before with Neverwinter Nights trying to get what they were doing, and they were doing it really well, where basically you have your dungeon master who can throw down little quests or mini objectives and throw down, like, engage traps for the four other players to go through. And yeah, it's all like video game. They can all queue up to it online. And the way they have it to where the dungeon master just won't try to wipe out all the four players at once is that they actually get their resources based on threat level. So they have, like, I guess up to like 100, but basically on how the game is going, the threat level will go up to, like, say if it's like 80%, then you can use that as a currency to then activate certain abilities and things of that sort, and I guess gain probably resources like XP or whatever currency they have in game. And so you're actually trying to always keep it intense when you can for the players, but without killing them. Because if you kill them, then there's zero intensity or a giant cut from the intensity because that person doesn't have anything to do. And so it's a really interesting reward system to try to create a fun game for the other players. And it kind of forces people to then create new content and to create the experience for other people and make it engaging and fun without it being unbalanced are overbearing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm more curious about that now. I do occasionally DM Dungeons & Dragons campaigns on and off when we can wrangle the time. And so I tend to like not get bogged down in combat too much because it just takes so long to actually resolve. Whereas if the computer actually resolves it for you, then that's...
Yeah, especially when you start getting more than like four players into like an RPG group, like combat. Yeah. It's just insane. Just takes forever.
The one last game I want to mention that I saw at PAX, although I probably should just save these and talk about them over the next however many episodes, is Gang Beasts. Have either of you seen this one?
No.
This is a game where it's one of those like Towerfall-esque party games, but it's like four players. You could do it with three, probably. Two might not be fun, but four players, and each player is in a sort of an arena. It's like each level is different, but they're kind of look like kind of like gummy bear beast things, and they grab. You have to grab your opponents and throw them off the edge, and the way that the controls are makes it so that you're really good at grab. You can grab and you can jump and you can kind of squirm out of the way. So like, it's not like you would imagine like in Mario, like you grab someone, you pick them up and they're just like, ah, and they're being held. It's like you're actually gripping, like you grab their shoulder and then you grab their side and they're sort of jumping and then sort of dragging you off. And then, you know, sometimes what happens is someone will pull both people off by accident and sometimes they'll break free and then be able to kind of kick someone off. And it just ends up being this sort of exact chaotic party game.
Sounds very visceral too.
Oh, it's super visceral. And each round only lasts for like 20 seconds. Like one of them starts on two of the players are on one semi truck, the roof of one semi truck, and two of them are on the roof of a neighboring semi truck, and the semi trucks are going down the freeway. And so it's like, this is not going to last very long. And of course, it doesn't last very long.
This is like really high intensity, but for a very short amount of time. Nice.
Yeah. And it makes a great spectator thing for something like PAX. There's always I saw it being played in multiple places and at parties and stuff like that. And like, there's always this big crowd of people. Green wins.